This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's a special occasion for a number of reasons. First and foremost, because we have John Palmasino and Anne-Sophie Renskog here from Basel in Switzerland with us for this program. But also, it's a special occasion because it's the culmination of a year-long seminar, the RBSL Bergman Foundation Seminar at the University of Pennsylvania. Over the course of the year, the students in my seminar have worked very intensively with Anne-Sophie and with John towards tonight. And we hope that afterwards you'll spend some time in the vault with this exhibition. It'll be up through May 18th. But it's inaugurated tonight with a new one or two-hour old big block of ice, which will melt as we're talking. So over the course of the year, the students in the seminar, all of whom are here tonight, worked with John and Anne-Sophie, often through Skype, through all sorts of email and video technologies, researching the conflict-ridden northern territories, the northern hemisphere, in particular the North Pole, and kind of seeing the northern hemisphere and the north as a metaphor for so many things in the popular media, in science, in so many fields, literature, of course. The students and Anne-Sophie and John kind of collated material. They, in a way, tried to constitute an archive, a veritable taxonomy for a region that until now has eluded, let's say, our grasp. And so what you see in the vault, what John will speak to and what hopefully you'll see afterwards, you'll participate in, is a floating, in a way, surface, a surface which is an archive. And rather than the archive being displayed on the walls in a very static way, we've opted for a very fluid and changing topography, a topography which adjusts as you enter the room and as you interrupt and kind of alter the water balance. When John and Anne-Sophie kind of met, when I met with them in Basel, I asked them what they would want to do with us and what they wanted to do with the seminar. And this was, I guess, about a year ago now. And what they proposed was a project entitled North. And for them, it was an occasion, I think, to think in their own work, but also to think with us about how water has rapidly become the central issue in the management of inhabited territories. And in particular, at least for the seminar, we're interested in disputes about sovereignty. We're interested in disputes about water rights. We're interested in mineral resources and their exploitation, in underwater oil exploration. And these were some of the issues with which we began. We read texts that ranged from Zygmunt Bauman on uncertainty and insecurity, fear, to, let's say, everything from Bruno Latour and Jacques Rancière on curatorial practice, to Membe, let's see, the list goes on and on, to Rem Koolhaas, to the Harvard Project on the City. The readings went in all sorts of ways, and the idea of the seminar was, although it originated in the Department of Art History, to in a way see it as a seminar which would explode and which would kind of result in a series of disciplinary interventions. And so we spanned in our readings everything from geopolitics to literature to architecture proper. And then the only other quick thing I'm going to say by way of an introduction is that John and Anne-Sophie are doing, at least from my standpoint, really amazing work, and it was a pleasure to work with both of them. One of the reasons that they make so much sense to work with here is that their practice spans architecture, it spans literature, it calls into question the normal ways that curatorial practice plays out, the normal ways that artists and architects display their work. And so we wanted to work with them because we thought that we would learn from them, and which we have very much so. But we'd learn in a way about the politics of exhibition display. We'd learn about how to do something differently than the way it conventionally is understood to have been done. So it's a real, real pleasure to have both of you here. It's been an honor, and it's been a funny process, which I think John will speak to. But we have enormous respect for you both, and before you run off to China in just an hour and a half, we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. The way the evening's going to play out is John is going to give a very short presentation about the project and their work at Territorial Agency. The idea is that we want to produce, in a way, a veritable document of the evening. So we're recording tonight. There's lots of microphones. We ask that you all participate, you all speak. We very much want to hear from you. But we ask that you speak into a microphone when you do that. So, So without further ado, John.
Thank you, Aaron, for everything. First of all, for the invitation. We are very pleased to be here, and we were very thrilled to work throughout the year with you and all the students. It's very, very good to discuss some, I think, urgent questions. We are very much dealing with some ideas that we feel are urgent, and we feel there's an urgency to not only discuss them, but really to engage with them. And they spin off more or less from 1 year ago at the conference that you organized together with surgeon Giovanni Givet Weiss and Catherine Carl, Evasions of Power, and where I was trying to present a topic related to a very difficult situation at that moment, maybe you remember, with 11 British Marines being sort of kidnapped by Iranian forces at the tip of the northern waters of the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. And the question was clearly where they were positioned when they were stopped by the Iranian forces, and who owned the waters they were traveling on. And a second, apparently disconnected event that sort of sparked our interest in the North is a very curious thing that happened during the summer. So what happened, of course, was that there was this mission that started off in Murmansk to sail through the Arctic Ocean and then launch two submarines that will deposit a titanium flag of the Russian Federation exactly at the North Pole in order to sort of repeat what Armstrong did on the moon almost 30 years ago, in order to not to claim sovereignty, but at least to make the first step on the bottom of the sea. Of course, many speculations began immediately. It's a bluff. It's made like Titanic. It's not real. But what was really at stake was really blurred by the incredible culture that we live in, one that we can only refer to a very romantic movie rather than what is really at stake. And what was really at stake with that gesture is probably one attempt to inhabit one part of the world which is probably the last part of the world that we think is untouched. And so our interest in these two events, on one side the almost impossibility of telling where in the Gulf the British Marines were positioned, and on the other side the very clear geographical coordinates of this event, but the unclear setup, the unclear relations, sparked an interest in understanding who owns the waters, especially what is it, what does it mean to own the water of the North Pole? And what is really interesting is, of course, that it's been probably the most important question of European civilization in the last 500 years. How do you deal with open seas? How do you go out of that little part of the world that is Europe in order to deal with the routes towards China? Of course, if you sail west, you encounter another continent, but the aim is really to go by sea to China. And the idea, of course, is an idea of that is regulated, as you might imagine, by international law. Who owns the sea is really a question of geometry that is stated very clearly in a resolution of the United Nations about the 12 nautical miles of the so-called territorial waters. And but the question is, of course, not the 12 nautical miles, but what is beneath the surface, what is beneath the oceans. And it's very interesting that these issues also are developing from a northern sea. This is an image of a ship war off the coast of Nova Scotia, where the meeting between the famous meeting between Churchill and President Roosevelt took place, about where they drafted the first sketch of the United Nations Charter. It was the first attempt to set up a complete set of regulations that will try to deal with a world without borders. So who owns the northern waters is somehow an attempt by two nations at war with the Nazi regime to deal with perpetual peace. So it immediately this thing started to become bigger and bigger. And so the declaration by the United Nations, which is a very interesting document, is actually not the declaration of the United Nations that you know, but it's clearly a declaration by the United Nations at war with the Nazi regime. That is, the Allied forces. So the very idea of the United Nations sparks from an idea of being at war, and it gems out of an idea of controlling the Northern Atlantic. Who will control the Northern Atlantic will operate an idea of perpetual peace. Of course, the North is probably so embedded in our imagination through nature and through the incredible presence of almost overwhelming presence of the ice and the difficulties of inhabitation, that we tend to forget how already it is wrought in a system of regulations and codes that go well beyond the actual positioning of human bodies in that environment. These are images about the Russian presence in the north. And of course, it's very interesting that the very act of inhabitation of such a harsh environment resembles the idea of the outer space, of inhabiting outer space. And so what we're trying to do with the seminar here, it's a very simple issue. It's an attempt to understand the geometries of sovereignty. When the Russians tried to position the flag at the bottom of the North Pole, what they were really trying to do was to prove that there is a continuous mountainous ridge underwater, a submarine mountainous ridge that connects the continental shelf of Russia all the way to the North Pole. And by doing that claim, they are referring to a particular article of the Law of the Sea that says clearly that the continental shelf is for unique exploitation of the country that it belongs to. So if Russia can claim that there is a continuous shelf between its continent and the North Pole, they can claim sovereignty or access to the submarine natural resources. What is interesting is, of course, that immediately that sparked a number of claims. Norway started claiming access to the North Pole through Svalbard. Denmark, through connection with the Greenland. Of course, Canada. They immediately opened a new military base up in the Northern Territories. The US didn't do anything. We'll come back to that. Japan started claiming sovereignty. China, or a number of countries. It's very interesting that also countries that have no access to the northern latitudes, no access to even the Arctic Pole, like Japan, started claiming sovereignty on the north. In the sense that Japan, through a claim of the islands north of its territory, the ones that are basically at the east of Siberia, are claiming further up. So there's sort of a claim double removed of sovereignty from Japan. But I just wanted to quickly show you what is the North Pole and then start a little conversation. This is a helicopter sound of a tourist trip to see the North Pole. And of course, when you bring a tourist to the North Pole, it's you can just bring him wherever you want and then back, because there's no such thing as a clear location. The ice pack is constantly moving, it's constantly shifting. But there is a problem, of course, that the satellites now provide constant GPS data. So you actually have to go to the North Pole in order to say that you are there. And it's very interesting that it happens through the satellites. Another outer space, it's exactly like the outer space of the sea. The outer space is also a space which is under a set of claims of sovereignty. Claims about territorial extension. So what happens is that you have the former Soviet Union, now the Russian Federation, defining what is outer space. And outer space is, by international law, neutral, as the maximum altitude where there is a presence of oxygen. And the US claiming that the outer space is the minimum possible orbit around the globe. So you will have... it's related to technology. If the faster you go, basically, the lower you can have an orbit, and you could have, technically speaking, outer space starts like 5 centimeters above the surface. So where do you actually manage to operate is a technical issue. But the relation of sovereignty to the north is probably also more interesting than just a technical issue of the how to claim to the United Nations. But it has to do really with your presence in the world. I said that I would come back to the fact that the US didn't claim yet. And it's very interesting because in order to claim sovereignty on a piece of continental shelf, you have to apply to a special commission of the United Nations that regulates the so-called UNLOS, the Law of the Seas. And the United States don't recognize this committee, and they don't recognize it exactly in order to leave the claim of sovereignty open, because the committee actually requires a very strict timeline in order to make these requests, and so that's why Norway and Russia are all doing these attempts now, because the timeline is running over. In 2009, it will be the last opportunity to claim sovereignty, and the U.S. are rather not limiting the idea of sovereignty. It's a very interesting relation to questions of territory. But at the same time, the North is so much embedded in our culture through an idea of modernity, I think. We have this idea of purity and immaculate spaces up there, almost as immaculate as the idea of modernity. It's probably the last part of the world where modernity is not really linked with its failures, with its wicked, evil part, like fascism, Nazism, and so on. But at the same time, the ice is melting, and it's melting through a very clear relation to modernity, through a very clear relation to urbanization processes throughout the world. So the different claims are not only for underwater resources, but are also claims for reopening the famous or infamous Northwest Passage. So if the ice melts, you will be able to reconfigure entirely the geography of the world. So these are some of the themes that we discussed at the beginning with the students. And it's very interesting that the project took a very articulated form, in the sense that immediately it was clear to us that we should tackle this issue, not in a straightforward way, in a frontal way, but rather in a lateral attitude, trying to find as many connections as possible. So what you will see here in the vault is the first display of the archive of the North that the incredible students have been collecting throughout this month. You will see an archive which is a floating archive. It's not structured. It's almost impossible to impose on this area another layer of structuring. But we really tried to use the format of the exhibition as a way of entering issues of inhabitation. It was very interesting that we had so many different topics come up, from comics to really controversial ethical points. For instance, Wendy was bringing up yesterday about how do you represent minorities? Is it even possible to say something about who inhabits the North? Who is it that inhabits it?
And the other thing I think it's important to emphasize is when John uses the word lateral in describing the process by which the archive came into being, he means it in the sense, I think, as well, that the archive was not hierarchically determined in terms of where the documentation would come from. So in other words, we weren't privileging certain sources, like, let's say, a privileged news media outlet or a privileged research body or institute. We were really trying to be lateral in the sense of non-hierarchical in where this information came from, in how the taxonomy was organized. So we tried to encompass everything from popular culture as it deals with this issue, which has become quite impossible to overlook, to more scholarly and academic practices, which are more statistically analyzing or modeling the situation. We tried to create an archive which would reflect the diversity of ideas that are floating, so to speak, around this issue.
Literally floating, and you'll see it in the exhibit.
But how do you balance, for instance, the your practice, which emphasizes research as a form of practice, research as a form of production, research often being very statistical and analytical, privileging, let's say, certain modes and methodologies of knowledge production, with the lateral kind of all-encompassing reach of the archive?
It's very difficult. I think that there are always two different moments in research and practice, but we try to bring them as close as possible. I think what we usually say is that because we are architects and we tend to operate within a culture which is that of exclusion, It is a culture which goes more and more to finding one solution and excluding others in order to define things. It's about definitions. It's about clearly setting and demarcating roles. And at the same time, as urbanists, we are trying to deal with as many connections as possible. So it's an inclusive action. And inhabiting these two aspects, like the one of the design and the one of the research, is like a sort of schizophrenic attitude. You, at the same time, try to do two impossible things, to do things that are apparently at odds one with the other. I think it's, for us, crucial to keep them slightly separate, but almost touching one another. That's why we are really interested in these questions, because for us they are urgent. They completely redefine the way we think, for instance, of a project like the one that we're going to present in the coming days in Mongolia, because it redefines how the transformation of the inhabited landscape is occurring at many levels. It is occurring not only on the institutional level or the infrastructural and economic level, it is occurring really on the level of the single inhabitant. And we are really interested in finding connections between these two or multiple systems. So I think it's really interesting also to see how students can enter this lateral way in a very easy way.
And then the one last question, I think, before we open it up would be, I mean, last summer, I remember we were struggling to figure out what to call the project. We knew the title. The title was North. It was kind of a given in a way from the start when you had proposed it. But we didn't know if it should be called an exhibit or an installation or display. We were really conflicted. And maybe in hindsight, it was kind of a funny discussion to be having. It probably didn't matter so much. But I guess, what was it that you were afraid that it could turn out to be about? Why is it that it's played out in the way that it has? Of course, it's a collaboration, and so it's evolved and organically developed. But why was it so important, I guess, to you in particular, that it not be an exhibit, for instance?
Mm-hmm. I think that we want to... first of all, this is really a collaborative project. So what you see is just one part of a larger set of works, and most of it comes really from, not from us, but from the group. But what we really want to emphasize is this, trying to avoid a cut between like making a research and then pouring all that knowledge into one final product and representing the research, but rather the display or exhibit or whatever it is a way of producing the research. It is the research itself. It is the project itself. There's no distinction between the two. It's not that we have... There's a preliminary phase of research, and then you present things. What we are trying to do is really operating with materials. And what we are producing is also materials. And that's why I think it's this also amorphous situation.
So I met John thanks to Catherine and Serjan. Serjan Weiss, who's here, and whose class is also here. Catherine Carl is in the back. And they had proposed that John and Sophie be invited to the Evasions of Power conference. But that led to this, and I was wondering maybe, Serjan, if you want to jump in and say a few words to determine where the conversation goes next. You've seen this project, in other words, evolve. You've seen it evolve and devolve, go through all sorts of phases. Recently, you probably found out we were about to flood the vault with water, something which has posed all sorts of logistical problems, and which, until 2 hours ago, was a big question if it would work, if it would bring down the building, so to speak, with some flood underneath. And so I guess, how does the project strike you? What questions does it pose for you?
Well, first of all, I can't really pose a real question. It's more a discussion. I can just say that possibly what I'm asking is whether this process was more a surprise for you than for me. I have a feeling it was also a surprise for you. Mm-hmm. And because for me, as a kind of phenomenological reading, it looks more of a kind of, Odyssey 2001 in a frozen age, in a certain way. You know, it's an interesting focus that you're bringing in, because And maybe that's also the question on the scales of geopolitics that we are discussing in our seminar, which maybe could lead to a certain question of if we talk about scales, and if we kind of follow up Aaron's question on the process and the final product. Can you two kind of reflect on the issue of the scale as a means of control, or a scale as a means of opening up the discourse? Because I have a feeling that there is a certain dialectics in this process, that where you talk about scale of an exhibition as a device, right? But at the same time, John, you talk about the scale of a discourse as one which is outside of the control. So I'm going to kind of
I think it's very surprising, and you're right. I think what we tend to forget is that when you intervene in the cultural field, you're actually producing culture, and culture is not what you do, but it's how it is then disseminated, and it has a life of its own. But still you can do things, still you can intervene. It's really like intervening in a city. You can change a building, but hopefully it changes much more than just its plot. I think in that sense, when we talk about different scales, that of the discourse, that of the exhibition, that of the northern territories, that of sovereignty, outer space, it's like also almost going ad infinitum, starting from the micropolitics to go, to having to deal with huge areas. How can we even dare to say something about such a situation? I think that is exactly the moment when the notion, the architectural notion of scale starts being interesting, starts being operative, that you can do things with that notion. Yeah? The incredible discourse, especially I think in the 90s, about scale and basically scaling down and scaling up, finding patterns that you will repeat at different lengths, at different areas. I think it's a very interesting modality of thought, because it allows you to operate outside of scale. It allows you to operate with more or less the same tools with issues that deal with the United Nations, and issues that deal with how you build a vault in Alaska. One of the students found this incredible manual on how to use concrete in order to avoid the danger of fire in the north. You find incredible things exactly by operating with that architectural tool.
I mean, as a curatorial tactic, it's true the project was controlled in a certain sense. It was always structured from the start as something that would result in a project in this vault. So it was very much, let's say, to use this word scale differently, it was very much a project from its inception that had a very localized, laboratory-like kind of environment as its final product. At the same time, for us, this was necessary because we were undertaking a series of kind of, methodologies of curiosity. We're trying to think of curatorial practice as... in a way, as a model of curiosity, as a methodology of curiosity. We didn't know where it would lead. And with every week, the project seemed to scale outwards in a way. It seemed to spin out of control. The students and I were kind of often expressing our exasperation towards each other at the open-endedness of it. So there was indeed this degree of kind of seeing the vault, this space which is historically always associated with storage, with preservation, and which here is oriented with the, linked up with the preservation of cultural artifact. It was very much the case that we saw that ultimately as kind of this localizing kind of space that would like kind of ground us in a way. As this archive started to emanate in all directions, kind of ending up in the New York Times, ending up in the far reaches of the internet, ending up in the South Pole more often than not. almost every project we did at Slot this year, Werner Herzog, for instance, first and foremost, his recent film, Encounters at the End of the World, in Antarctica. Almost every project that we undertake this year started to pull itself into the vault, or we started to bring it into this project. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, indeed, there was this need to control it, let's say, but from a different vantage point. It was just metastasizing in a way. The North, this region, which seems to be so far from us, in fact became quite quickly this zone which reminds us of the importance of the nation state, the importance of territorial boundaries at that moment when, at least in some of our other projects, borders seem to have been so fluid lately. Globalization seems to have been defined as this moment in which borders become completely permeable, passable, fluid, changing. And this project reminded us of both the need and the problem of borders kind of being resurgent today in a very different way, not fluid at all, but constantly static or at least fraught with complexity and conflict. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it expresses the as you said, the importance of scale in this project, the complications as to how this project could have played out and from which vantage point it could be articulated or addressed.
Probably a few notes on how this project is organized, and you will see there's a lot of documents and materials. These are just a printout of a larger collaborative effort, and that is to put up a starting point of an online archive that is constantly growing. And then there's a little projection, and at the moment you will just see some images, but what is really interesting is that some of the students propose to have a series of screenings of films that somehow relate to the topic, and that is immediately the point. How do you make a screening that somehow relates to a topic like North? Then, of course, you bring in Hitchcock, North to Northwest, and all kinds of other things.
The Day After Tomorrow.
Day After Tomorrow. Or even, yeah. Most hopefully, the film North that started at Slot.
Our first event consisted of, here 6 years ago, a film that had been originally meant to show in New York, and 2001, September 11th, kind of displaced it. And so a year later, we premiered it here. And it was a film about, immediately it goes in a different direction than this topic, Celine's novel, North, a novel which kind of is so much about the complexity of, in a way, upholding a leftist discourse today. And so Gary Indiana and an artist, John Boscovich, who recently passed away, had collaboratively produced this amazing film called North. And so we had brought a series of critics and artists together, including those that had produced it, to engage in a conversation. So just the other week, I guess just while you were here this week, we remembered that project, actually. And so that'll be pulled into the screening program.
Probably the students would want to say something.
I was kind of interested about the idea of the fluid boundaries, because I don't know how much you went into looking at the Northern Territories as far as not only the North Pole, but the other territories within Canada as far as within the Arctic Circle. Because it's more about an idea of selective jurisdiction here. It seems like what you're looking at here is claims on these territories. And a few years ago, I think it was about 3 years ago, there was a streak of murders up in Nunavut. It was a few hours north of Iqaluit. And usually the RCMP, so the federal government in Canada, gets involved in those. And as far as this streak, since Iqaluit is supposed to be autonomous, so they only have a selective jurisdiction over the territory, they didn't get involved. So it was all about the local government to resolve the issues. So in this sense, they were only taking what they wanted from the territories. So the territories are not being defended with the same rights as other Canadian provinces are. Well, it's not really a province of territory. But they're still, the Canada is still claiming some valuable resources from those territories. And it seems to be what's going to be happening, and the reason for which there are so many claims for North Pole. I guess it's not the same issue as far as it's not being inhabited, but it's only a very selective jurisdiction. So there, this level of responsibility that's not present as far as the government that's claiming it. So as far as either environmental responsibility, it's lacking. So it's only beneficial. It's only draining those regions rather than trying to inject anything. So I think that might not.
I think this is very interesting because it shows that what you, as far as I understand, what you are telling us is that these issues not only revolve around questions of sovereignty, but also of jurisdiction, which are issues that pertain territories within one sovereignty. And so what we really find is that there is more and more a situation where the space of operation of our institutions and the way that we organize our, let's call them society, I prefer another word, I prefer the word polity, are getting two systems that don't match anymore. We see really, even in these situations which are apparently minor, a crisis of the territorial idea of the nation state, which is an idea which was born, very interesting, out of an attempt to define the openness of the seas. In 1603, the Dutch seized a boat in Jakarta, which was at that time under control of the French, and they took the treasure, and then the question was, can we keep this treasure? And it was like a real fortune in the sense that it triplicated the endowment of the then-to-be-born East India Dutch Company. It started in time. The Dutch said, the seas are open for everyone. They're free. Freedom of the seas. So you see that 1603 is also a moment when the idea of the nation state start, begins. And so it's really an idea of controlling a territory, an idea of like a Cartesian idea. It's very interesting because it's, again, at the same time, the geometrical attitude that we inherited from this incredible French culture is still permeating issues like who is responsible when there's a clash, who's responsible about what is underfoot, who's responsible about our air, who's going to save the... We were discussing yesterday, can we even talk about the fact that people in the north eat differently from us, they have a different diet? Can we talk about what they eat and how that is being put in danger? You will say, no, we shouldn't. That is interfering with somebody else's life. But who's responsible for that saying?
That was pretty much it. It's ownership but lack of accountability, and that's a few of the issues that the Northern Territories in Canada have, and it's that They belong to Canada. They're territories of Canada, but Canada doesn't seem to be really responsible for those territories. And so it's a one-way relationship.
At one point yesterday, in fact, we had a series of words that were painted on the walls, and one of them was judgment in a way, jurisdiction, let's say. And just this morning we painted over it. We decided that in fact we didn't want the explicitness in a way to be made manifest in that way. But indeed we were thinking about these issues, the complexity of the issues, the dialectical nature of them. This, on the one hand, indeed, this territorial encroachment and definition. On the other hand, this absconsion from any responsibility. Right? So on the one hand, like an outright, you know, territorial expansion, right, that you see taking place right now, or at least a series of claims, geopolitical claims, often motivated by economic profit, let's say, and yet at the same time a complete abdication of any responsibility concomitant with that. So indeed we were dealing with that complexity. We're trying to figure out how that could be made explicit, if it should be made explicit, if indeed that's what's floating underneath the ice as it's melting, if in a way it's already, you know, figured there through the archive, through this floating archive, which is so unstable. And as the water was going in, we were constantly worrying if the water would, in a way, take over the archive and submerge it. So no, the fragility, the ephemerality of it all, the precarious nature of how to define what's going on in there was very much part of the project. It was very much a complicated conflict for us as well. But John, yesterday you said you had this amazing discussion with the students at the Green Line. And then you came back and we started working, and I never heard about this discussion.
I hope it's still possible to continue that. It's up to you.
Well, I wasn't there, so you have to tell us. But
Wendy.
I was more asking you about how you felt about maps, alternative ways of mapping things, and how the archive is, in a way, a map itself. And in a way, I was speaking about how if there's an alternative to mapping things that in a non-diagrammatical manner. And now that I think about it, what we just did for the North Project is very much so. Mm-hmm. Because it's an installation, but at the same time, it's also a map, it's a record.
I think someone of you in our previous sessions by Skype was saying that the eyes itself is an archive. It is a repository of information that we try to now uncover by drilling, by taking samples of the
ice cores, getting long ice cores from the ice to look back millions of years to see how many oxygen molecules are stored in the ice and find out more about global warming and the cycles that are involved.
So in that sense, what you are trying to archive is already an archive. So the archive of the archive of the archive, and then you try to make a map of an archive and a map of a territory. And it's very interesting because immediately you start mixing two levels or two scales of operation. One is that of the organization of thought, like an encyclopedia, like an incredible babble of encyclopedia. And at the other level, you try to deal with geographies, with relations that deal with territories, with extensions of land and water. And to go, probably another question that was very interesting for us about the territories of Canada and is, what is the space of operation? It says, by international law, defines clearly what is land and what is water. But if the water is frozen, there's no discontinuity. The space of operation is enlarged. And so one of the claims of Canada is really that the Inuit have sovereignty on a larger land, which is water. So what is really interesting is that the claims of the North Pole are putting into questions like not only the mapping system, not only our systems of knowledge, but what is land and what is water. Before land was land and water was water. Now you can say that ice is land. It is not, but it's land. So it's really interesting that there's at the same time like an extension, like an horizontal extension of our discourse on spaces of operation and a vertical one. You have a verticality. So the Russians going to the bottom of the sea and using satellite imagery produced at the highest point. And so we have really like an architectural extension of the North Pole, which is waving beyond the Arctic Circle. And I think it's really interesting that what we tend to imagine as the last uninhabited space is already ensconced with all of these sea setups. It's already full of these controversial and conflictual operations. Even without being there, you are creating problems of cohabitation. It's very problematic, I think. It's a very urgent thought for us. I think it's very interesting that we start this, and I really wish that we will be able to continue this project in the future.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was interested in was how we actually collected the documents, and specifically kind of the use of the internet as kind of a major kind of connection of the space, and how you're talking about cohabitation, and how maybe you could talk about how the internet is a form of kind of cohabitation that relates kind of to the space that we kind of created, in which we had different points of view. We had a lot of blogs, we had a lot of, you know, news articles, as Aaron said. We didn't really look at any one authority for this, and whether you believe that the internet kind of can parallel kind of the activities that we're kind of creating in a cohabitation that discusses a location that is uninhabitable in a sense, such as the North.
But you need a technology there.
Huh?
You also need the technology to have that.
Yes. And that also kind of goes into the question of how do we create an archive and who kind of creates an archive.
Well, the internet doesn't just parallel, you know, this project. It very much determined it, right? It was very much a project which emerged out of that peculiar sense of dislocation that only the internet can maybe provide us with today. We had a series of, for those of you that aren't in the seminar, we had a series of amazing Skype conversations to inaugurate this project, and really that kind of technological series of hindrances that marked the first one continued throughout. So we always had either video or audio, and if we had audio, it usually was one way. Mm-hmm. And so we had a series of missed encounters, I guess, that at the conclusion of this project, or at least at its launch, seem so appropriate, but at the time were so complicated and tricky. The internet was at once the medium that this project was supposed to, you know, take form through. It was also kind of haunting us at every step of the way and kind of making it impossible to figure out what it would lead to or where it was heading.
Can I ask Peter, a question?
Yeah.
It seems that the North Pole has become a place of action in the sense of different countries, nation states are rushing to, even if it's just a symbol or a gesture, to do something. Everybody's trying to do something. And so I guess the question that this exhibit sort of puts on the table is then, maybe what is the role of non-governmental actors? What is the role of architects and artists and thinkers? You know, do they have some say in, you know, in what's happening? And what most really amazed me about the work that went into this project was that seeing the North Pole as a nexus of so many different fields, from politics to sovereignty to global warming, to geology, you could keep listing and keep listing and it would never end. And it's such a interwoven fabric of what's at stake and what are the factors and how do you consider it. And I know that I personally wouldn't have had that understanding of how complex it was without actually trying to collect an archive. And so for me, that sort of changed the meaning of the archive. It wasn't so much a depository for here's all the information, but it was a means of learning and exploring the subject. And so to go back to the original point then, how do artists or architects respond to what's happening? Is it just by surfing the internet and seeing what's out there? Is it more than that? And I guess this isn't such a direct question, but it's not a very direct topic either. So if you could talk about that, if there's anything to talk about.
I think that it is a very important question. It's really about urgency. What do you do? What is to be done? And you say, everything is already been done. There's so many things happening. So you are one among the many. And that is really the interesting thing, because at the same time it's overwhelming. It's too big. And you cannot do anything. You cannot do anything in front of such an extension of power, an extension of resources and geography. You're lost. But at the same time, probably there is an interesting question, and that is really about learning. And that is putting in question the notion of place, of location. Probably the role of intellectuals and of public intellectuals, to connect to Sergeant's seminar, is really that of positing a series of notions of learning, of inquiry, so that the individuals that form our very complex societies, always in a shifting conditions, more and more so at the age of globalization, will probably start questioning more. I think the role of architects and intellectuals, artists, is really to pose questions rather than immediately find things to do. It's already a lot to pose a question, I think. At the seminar at Temple, I see Lindsay over there, and she, of course, collaborated in the organization of this. Thank you. There was a discussion on that level. How do you do things? What is even the role of a professional situation? I think this is not only a question in general terms, but can really address specific professional boards, professional practices, and so on, across nation states.
This was also something we talked about when we were reading Bruno Latour, for instance, this kind of specific attempt to define an archive not as a series of artifacts, but as a kind of a series of interpretive acts or positions, right? So to go back to that statement you made, I mean, indeed, it crystallized in this project in a way, but that was that issue we've been trying to figure out.
There's someone over there.
Can we ask you to come up and just speak into the microphone?
Has to do with territory in a more maybe general matter, not necessarily so specific to the North Pole, but in scenarios where you're talking about following the geometry of a country and it's sort of sovereign to your power across the water. I was wondering what your thoughts were on countries that begin to take water and convert it to an extension of their land. So now the geometry of the country or the continent for that matter is also changing, where now you're sort of competing of water literally sort of transforming and reconstructing itself to become inhabitable land. Mm-hmm. Versus land that's already existing and it's sort of taking it over to become part of the realms of it.
Well, it is very interesting because the so-called, I was reading it this morning, the UNCLOS, the United Nations Committee on the Law of the Seas, has a long description of artificial islands and artificial land and how you deal with them. So probably we can go quickly through them. I don't know if you managed to see it, but what is at stake is, of course, an idea of natural resources. And how do you deal with them as soon as they are man-made? What is the artificial claim on inhabitation? How can you claim something? How do you claim something that is completely man-made? Can you just go out, let's say, and build an artificial island in the middle of the Gulf? And the operation is very clear. Artificial island, installation structures in the exclusive economic zone, conservation of the living resources, utilization of the living resources, stocks occurring within the exclusive economic zones of two or more coastal states or both within exclusive economic zone and in an area beyond and adjacent to it, highly migratory species, marine mammals. No, it's completely charted out. It's very interesting. But there's nothing that tells that you that these features cannot be completely reshaped. So probably we are living in the first time in history where we completely can reshape our planet. We can reshape the features of our planet. And your question about how do you deal with it, it's probably not only interesting in terms of land fills or land extensions. I'm thinking, for instance, of incredible situations in Hong Kong, you know, when you double the surface of the city, or Singapore, that literally rebuilt artificially its territory. But also in a situation where we can artificially build life, we can modify life. One of the incredible things that we encountered in this research was the fact that we are running out of molecules to make drugs. In the last 50 years, there was if you make a chart of the molecules that were discovered and where they were from, the ones from land went up, and then now they're like in a Gaussian bell, and we are running out of them. So we are about to undertake an incredible exploration of the underwater life in order to discover more molecules, but at the same time we can produce molecules. We are at the verge probably of a new era where we can produce artificial life. And what is that going to how is that going to reverberate on our daily experiences? It's even more complicated than one just thinks. So probably we need to even be more alert.
Becca?
Yeah. Well, I missed part of this, so I'm not sure if this has been discussed before, but I would want to... My question deals with more of the installation here, and I was just wondering, I mean, as you know, this the physical installation has gone in a variety of manners. We've thought about very different ways to install this, ways to show the archive, etc. And I was just wondering, we've decided upon, have we talked about exactly what it is? So we've decided upon this water installation with ice and documents and the entire archive, and it's taken a very artistic form of presenting this archive. And I was just wondering, would you consider the archive itself an artwork? Would you consider the installation an artwork? Or where do you kind of draw the line? Or both? I'm just curious about what your thoughts are on how...
I don't know. It's always a big question. When we were doing a project at Documenta, we were at the beginning terrified. You have to go and show something among the best artists. But on the other hand, whatever you will do will be judged according to a set of criteria that are way beyond your control. So I don't think that it's even necessary to pose the question, how is this to be considered? Is it an artifact? Is it a piece of art? Is it trash? Is it leftover? Maybe, probably, the only interesting aspect for us is to consider what we have here, like a complete trash system. It's the leftover, it's the material leftover of a learning process. It's not. We're not interested in coming up with a final product, but it's really like producing like a mold that finds its way through the ground and produces like a head.
You were very much part of this project. It was a collaboration, and it was a project which called into question the idea, the discrete fiction of authorship, the idea that an artist acts individually and is creative all on their own, creating something like an artwork, for instance. Here, the collaborative ethos very much called that authorial intent or control into question. So I don't know what the artwork would consist of, although I think you're right that there's a poetic effect. We in the end, opted for an effect, in a way, that we wanted to leave the viewer or participant with. And maybe that would be partly what you were getting at, why that poeticism as a defining characteristic of what resulted.
I think it's also interesting that nobody really took that decision. You discover things while you do. I don't really know who...
We don't know who gave us the idea or how we arrived at
who
the idea
did it?
Of submerging the vault in water, or at least coating the floor in water. Does anybody know?
He knows. Maybe
you know.
Maybe
he okay.
I was wondering if you were aware of Kiki Smith's project, the columns of water.
Yeah.
I think it's in Norway.
Yeah.
And perhaps that was maybe an influence. Yeah. And... to kind of think about, I mean, I found that project to be very like a cohesive kind of analysis of what you're talking about, kind of the metaphor is inherent in water and the potentials in water, which I think a lot of this seems to be speaking about. That kind of the borderlines of, and the shifting, you know, the state change inherent in water.
Of course, there are many influences, and the probably what we discovered is that cohesion was not what even our aim. Rather, really the meltdown, a complete disruption of any kind of idea of aggregate. It's really a project that works on many, many levels of disaggregation, on disassociation, fractures and ruptures.
But no, you're right to call to mind these past practices which have utilized the same media, maybe the same maneuvers as some of the ones we employed. Just on this wall right near the vault, we showed some years ago an amazing artist, Klaus Rinke, who really has no audience here in the United States, who 30 odd, more than 30 odd years ago, did a series of water transformations where he would relocate water from the river to the gallery, from the gallery to the river, in buckets, in pipes, and tubes. And there's a whole long list of artists that have worked in this way. Wendy called our attention to a show that all of us had completely overlooked, a show at the Deutsche Guggenheim, which was a show called North, very much filled with, replete with all sorts of artists who had created works around this topic, this metaphor. I guess in the end, we indeed wanted to avoid the suggestion that we were creating, to go back to Becca's question, an artwork. Even if there was an effect, maybe, as I was saying, a poetic effect to it, we didn't want to create a cultural artifact or residue. We didn't want to create something discrete. We, in fact, as you said, wanted to create an archive from archives that already exist, to create a taxonomy of taxonomies, but one that was uncertain and unstable. And I don't know if any of you in the class want to talk about this, but the book that seemed to really mark you and touch all of us was the Zygmunt Bauman book on precariousness and insecurity and fear. And it caught me off guard. It didn't seem to be the book that I would have expected you to each have latched onto, each in your own way. But somehow that precariousness seemed to have become a defining feature of how we conducted ourselves and how we meditated on the project.
Yes, I feel like that kind of what you've just been saying about the fracturing, kind of the fractured approach that we took, kind of brings the conversation full circle, I guess, because the anecdote that we started with about the Canadian territories sort of evokes this fantasy that a lot of governments and people seem to operate under, of the North as sort of resources without responsibility, as this sort of vast, unclaimed, unmarked territory that's sort of up for grabs, and that you can lay claim to without really any other forms of accountability, without having to exercise jurisdiction, I guess. And so I feel like the approach that we took by trying to fracture those fantasies of what North is, and by trying to get at it from like many different angles, has really been, I mean, that seems to be like the appropriate way to approach something like that. And the idea that we're running out of molecules and that we're going to turn to this sort of untapped resource in a similar hope, but maybe with a fuller awareness of all the complexities involved, is very interesting moving forward to like what's going to happen when the ice melts.
It already is. Yeah.
I have another question. Actually, the question that you announced earlier about issues of divisions. I would be really, really curious to hear you comment on that, especially because I think it is the interesting way to take and, you know, to fracture the image of something that is seen as one thing. So you have this dichotomy of the source and the fragmentation of the archive, right? So you work on the fragmentationary archive. But then, you know, there is this kind of like, of course, the imminent future of the division of the source. And to me, it's very interesting that there is a time lapse that countries can actually apply. It looks like applying for an internet domain, right? So you kind of apply for a certain amount of time. So that puts in a question that sort of the difference between the poles, you know, the South Pole then almost being in a certain future, being divided already, and then kind of recolonized. Now, can you give some more sense about when you speak of two different scales of expression, you know, the exhibition, the discourse, the product, and the actual, you know, ambition to follow the process, you know, to fragment the archive as a project? I mean, that's, in a way, somebody asked the question about the potentials of the archive. I think we design by making archives. In fact, the more we design by making archives, the more we can be in the future rather than be in the past.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that it seems, like in general terms, that we are going towards a situation where, as you say, the South, the Antarctica will be completely segmented like an orange. This incredible map, I'm sure that you all saw it, of the Antarctica being divided in slices. And it's not the actual situation. It's all the claims on it. They all say that they would eventually claim sovereignty or usage of that land. At the moment, they don't. And at the same time, we are in a situation where in the north, we are you have different claims, but there's no unity. Probably what we will have to work for is a unity, unitarian approach, which brings into question many other situations. Why start with the North Pole? Why not with the Amazon? Why not with Africa? Can we apply a similar situation really to another part of the world, which is probably even more urgent, that of Africa? Probably Lindsay has much to say about this. But I think it really, the question of division, of demarcation, is so crucial in our contemporary lives. And we cannot build without separating. That is the incredible situation that architecture is stuck into.
I mean, this may not answer your question, it may not respond so much to it either, but I mean, when you look at a book like, say, Derrida's Archive Fever, it's quite clear that for him there's nothing to be learned so simply from the archive. There's nothing to be found in it that unpacks, that in a way acts as a key. Rather that, Archive Fever is a warning. It's this very clear warning that you should never presume that the archive just speaks for itself. And that if you look hard enough in its recesses, you'll find what you're looking for. I mean, it's quite the reverse. He argues that the archive is just this kind of fountain of indecipherability. These attempts that constitute it, these attempts to make sense of it, are really what it consists of. There's no, in the case of Archive Fever, there's no Freud that Yerushalmi can find if only he opens the right door. The archive doesn't provide the answers. It just provides dispersals and divergences. That's actually what's so important about it. So I don't know if this answers your question, but that idea of dispersal was indeed, I think, for the class precisely the way we're defining the idea of an archive.
I think that, Sergin, you're completely right in saying that the more we design archives and through archives, the more we are heading towards the future rather than it probably again relates to the idea of undoing the situation of place as related to stability, to a clear stability, but rather dismantling that to open up questions of, let's say, inquiry, place as a modality of inquiry, openness. What is really at stake is an idea of openness.
I think in that respect, it's very interesting in this project that if you think maybe 6 years ago, it would not have been possible to do this because actually internet produced this project. And the fascinating thing is to see that organizations or institutions that relate to the North are actually only online. They don't have a geographical location. The university, the Arctic University, is in many countries. And for us, this was the very interesting part about this project, because it's a huge change in our culture that there is not a geographical location.
So technology is really probably the way out of this incredible dilemma of architecture.
I just want to add on to that. Well, maybe it's not so much a comment, not so much a question, but a comment. But I was just thinking while we were working on this, because I've worked at an archive on art, contemporary art in Hong Kong before, and I've read a lot about archives. That what came to my mind was a lot of archives are based on ethnographic research, actually being in that place and collecting information. Like, for example, like Walter Benjamin, he was in Paris, he collected stuff about Paris, he made an archive about his wanderings and imaginations. And like what Anne-Sophie was saying, our archive is so much about not being there, all because of the internet. And that just takes the whole personal approach towards an archive out of the question. but at the same time, it's so global and involves so many people, too. I think that was what really struck me with our own archive.
Well, I had a question that had to do with this idea of time and how you looked at the North in relation to time. Because it seems to me that the cycles of freezing and thawing and freezing again and you know, when you look at back millions of years, and so here we are and we have to learn in the present, and so how do we apply the knowledge that we get now, and how far in the future can we simulate our knowledge and thinking? So these are sorts of questions that I have, because it seems to me like my other response is to be really conservative about the sorts of changes that are happening and this idea of insecurity. So the insecurity makes me want to be conservative, but the idea of time and knowing that it's sort of endless, mm-hmm. like allows me to sort of be more open to kind of the actions that we have to take. So I don't know, any comments to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that when we began the project, we were very attentive to the apocalyptic tone, let's say, of media representations of the Northern Hemisphere and the North. And as the project went on, I don't know, maybe you guys in the seminar disagree, we kind of saw the North as a site of perpetual transformation, and this being one particular moment, which we can attempt to understand and analyze, but one moment in an ongoing and perpetual transformation of the environment, in a sense, man-made and otherwise. I guess temporality figures in the project in a very kind of debased and literal way, in that ice block that is melting. It was, I guess, a question for us, how does temporality figure in? And I guess it figures in the documentation, for instance, that calls attention to a more geological time frame. But in the display itself, or whatever we call it, exhibit, I guess there's that more poetic effect which attempts to convey some sense of temporality. But I don't know.
I think that in the end, what we have is culture. I have a student in London who did an amazing project on Iceland, on the elves, the invisible men. And she related the rise of the legends on the elves to the incredible migrations and wars and immigrations and invasions of Iceland. And so the men that are not there are not only invisible because they are like mythical figures, they are men that are gone. They are dying or displaced and relocated. And I think that it's really interesting to see culture as really like an attempt of humanity to deal with our temporality, the fact that we will, in the long term, there's only one thing that is sure, that we will all be dead. But what remains is culture, is beyond us. And probably that is also a very interesting situation about how do we deal in a culture. What is the role in culture? It's really just very basic, to remain something.
But indeed, finitude is the one thing we can't accept, as Babisa. So. But any last questions? The only reason I want to cut this short is because Anthony and John have to catch a flight in 15 minutes. but maybe if there's one last question, we could end on that note.
I just want to say thanks for the answer. Yeah. Actually, it's quite insightful.
Thank you. I just want to say it's actually a really successful experiment, what you've done. Thinking of it more about, okay, scales on one hand, but also the sort of the activity that this produces. I mean, also connected to the topic. And I think the kind of the melting of the topic and our hope that it will never melt, in fact, is possibly keeps the project together. Mm-hmm. For one reason, which really strikes me, is that you talk about culture, which we have, and yet you find a space which we kind of assume as a place for us that we kind of come from culture that either has a culture or does not have a culture. Mm. So its invasion of it is a culture. And at the same time, the kind of the impossibility of, you could call like a social project or any kind of project, polity, is underlined completely. So the ambition to design is in fact underlined. For me, that's really
it shouldn't melt.
Exactly.
That is the message. Yeah. It should not melt.
But it will. Yeah.
But it melts when you show. It melts when you show. And actually, can you go back? You have a photo of a Hotel Russia, I think, for some reason. I was wondering, they're going to go back to the scam. I think it is the only moment where it really is designed. That, in fact, because the Russian crew, as you know, they designed this basically thing by using Finnish submarines. So that's design. Design is a scam. In fact,
design is a scam.
Could you just say scam with an M?
Yes.
Scam.
Oh. It could be spam too.
So I guess I have just one or two last questions. I'll be very quick. I was thinking that maybe you guys could answer them in the front row. The first is, how are we going to convey this through the internet? Should we at all? Should it be a very ephemeral project that takes form here with a recording, for instance, of this conversation here and now? How should we go about, in a way, over the next few weeks, trying to map out the complexity of this project through some form or forms of documentation? And then the other question is for John. John announced that you have to tell us what lettering we need to put on the door before they run out. So maybe the question.
I answer immediately. I would like Article 76 of the Law of the Seas.
Okay.
About the claims on continental shelf. I will
vinyl lettering or just text?
It can just be a text.
Okay. Well, that's easy. I guess the other question is complicated. Who wants to pick a stab?
Claim the North. Go and claim the North yourselves.
Yeah, I think an expedition.
Yes.
And what of the internet, the very medium that, in a way, as we've all spoken, was so crucial to the construction of this project? Do we need to give back, or are we just, in a way, take?
Well, I mean, the idea of creating an internet, we were bouncing that, is kind of a nice kind of touch in order to kind of, even because we were talking about how we chose the documents. In a sense, there is an authority in that we were choosing the documents that were going into the space, and to create another archive, on the internet, such that people could, themselves also, challenge our own authority and kind of create their own space.
So less a poetic effect and more just, in a way, a binder of accumulation, in a way.
Yeah.
I have an opinion about it. Can I have an opinion?
Sure.
I would say that there was something really interesting about this idea of there's something really interesting about this idea of learning. And so if you, and word of mouth. And so kind of like if you don't document it, but each of these people now goes out and spreads the idea to, sort of like the butterfly effect, I think that there would be...
Disperses it.
Yeah, in a way that doesn't become static. And even the internet is sort of like, no, there's not going to be anybody to update it or anything like this. So
informality as a tactic. Okay, Becca?
I think it's definitely important that we continue this over the internet, particularly because it was such an integral part of compiling for this project. I would love to see, we talked about putting links, extra links that we didn't print out or things we didn't use up on the Slot website, documentation of the project. And I'd also love to have the ability for outsiders to email in something that they found on Arctic, and we can just simply add it to our archive, and therefore it becomes this sort of worldwide
floating archive.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And what about the ice? Should we stick it in our server? How should we convey that? Should we not? Should we do a time-lapse slideshow, or is that antithetical in a way to the project as such?
I think we should definitely be documenting this whole exhibit. I think we've discussed a lot of how this is going to start out very orderly, and we expect it to end at whatever time in a sense of chaos with wet documents and melted ice, perhaps overflow, you never know. So I think it's definitely important to document it in a time-lapse process.
If entropy is something that, it would be really part of that process, because as you said, John, you see it as that it shouldn't melt. So entropy may or may not, that's a big question, I think, about the future of the installation and the documentation.
Go and see it.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Anne-Sophie.
Thank you very much.